I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, for a lot of kids, basketball isn't just something to do. It's a way out and up. But are some of the coaches working with the youngest players looking out for the kids' interests or their own? We'll ask the author of Play Their Hearts Out, a coach, his star recruit, and the youth basketball machine. That conversation is coming up in a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about some of the difficulties many young men of color are facing in the classroom. A new report from the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights suggests that school discipline policies may not be colorblind. African American students, particularly boys, are far more likely to be expelled or suspended from school than students of other races. The report also detailed disparities in the quality of classes offered to minority students and the pay offered to teachers in schools that serve more children of color. We wanted to talk more about this, so we're joined now by Ruslan Ali. She is the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Education. She worked closely on the study, and she's with us once again. Welcome back to the program. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Michelle. Great to be here.
Now, the report covers more than discipline, and we're going to get to some of those issues in a minute, but discipline is where we want to start. According to this report, black students made up 18% of those covered in the survey, but black students were 35% of those who were suspended from school and 39% of those expelled, and the report said that black boys in particular were at greater risk. Can you just give us a sense of why you think that is?
Well, Michelle, it's really hard to find one reason or answer for these disturbing trends we're seeing across the country. Some of it, unfortunately, as we've seen over the last couple of years in our investigations, does have to do with different treatment on the basis of race. Sometimes we see students with the very same offenses, the very same history, receiving very different punishments. But that does not explain these very disturbing trends and the story that these data portend. Something else is happening here. What is terribly exciting about these data is we are now armed with the ammunition to find out what else is happening.
When this report came out, the Secretary of Education, your boss, Arne Duncan, said, quote, "The undeniable truth is that the everyday education experience for too many students of color violates the principle of equity at the heart of the American promise," unquote. Why did he say that?
Because when we look at these data, and as you mentioned, Michelle, what we released is what we're calling an opportunity gap tool. Data about the experiences that students have as they journey through pre-kindergarten, elementary school, middle and high school. What courses are they getting? What resources are we providing them? And across the board, on most of these indicators, students of color get less of everything that we know makes a difference in public education. That is a question of fundamental fairness.
You know, you can see where some people might argue or question whether race is the determining factor here or if race is a proxy for something else. So the question I would have is, do you know whether, say, students in the same school were treated differently or in the same community were treated differently? So you can really isolate race as being the variable.
That's a very good question. From these data, we cannot tell that. We know trends about suspension. We know much more than we ever knew before. Who's been suspended once, who's been suspended more than once, whether students are referred to law enforcement, whether they're arrested in school. But we don't know for what types of offenses, and we don't know in all cases if students that are treated differently for the very same activity. We have to ask ourselves further, and educators across the country, we hope, will look at these data, do some self-analyses about their schools, and ask themselves these same questions, and then set about changing these disturbing patterns.
How would you recommend they go about doing that?
We've provided some supports in the Department of Education, things like positive behavioral interventions and supports, alternative strategies to disciplinary actions, supports to ensure that the school environment is healthy, that teachers have classroom management professional development to help deal with these problems. As we've seen, and I've talked to educators across the country, they will tell me things like, "I'm trying to manage an already too crowded classroom. The easiest thing for me to do is put the problem child outside of my classroom to get the business of learning done for the kids that want to learn." While that might be understandable in those instantaneous decisions, we have to ensure that those kids that we call problem kids still get learning supports to stay in school.
You have to ask how much is conscious and how much of it is unconscious, that the same behavior that a child who looks one way might exhibit might be viewed in a certain way, but the same behavior that another child exhibits might be viewed in a very different way. It's kind of the saggy pants syndrome, if you don't mind my calling it that. I mean, there are people who would say, well, you know, the kid might be a NBA superstar's kid, but if his pants are sagging, you know, he's going to get followed in the mall. And it's just something that certain behavior, as expressed by certain people, just evokes a different reaction. Do you think that that might be possible? Or do you think that there are, again, other factors at work? Because I think some people are used to thinking of discrimination as being a conscious act. And some people suggest that perhaps it isn't.
I think we are, in fact, seeing that. We are seeing perhaps it's ignorance, perhaps it's a lack of understanding, perhaps it's a need for acceptance of different cultures. But we have seen in some of our investigations instances where the very same activity, it yields a different response on behalf of the adults. And some of those cultural perceptions do enter into the fray. But it's precisely these kinds of conversations that we're also seeing educators have with these data, where they're looking at them and they get a big aha and a heavy heart for not realizing that sometimes they are making those somewhat biased decisions.
On the other hand, you can see where people would look at this data and say, well, so what? If a child is acting out, as you put it, or behaving in a way that compromises the educational experience for other kids, I don't care what color he is, he needs to go, he or she. But as you point out, mainly he needs to go because every child's educational experience is compromised by poor behavior. And what do you say to that?
That's right, too. You cannot rush to judgment around these data. Equalizing disciplinary rates is not the fix to these patterns. It's going to require a community effort, a student effort, a parent effort, an educator effort, and certainly Washington needs to support those efforts. But these data tell us there's no one problem. There's no one solution, but we know for sure that if students aren't in school, they can't learn.
We're talking about racial disparities in discipline and other aspects of American schools. Our guest is Ruslan Ali. She's the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Education. I'm going to switch gears a little bit, but it's a related subject. You've spoken previously on this program about bullying and the need to take school bullying seriously. A lot of jurisdictions now are looking at criminalizing this behavior or taking more stringent action against this kind of behavior, sanctioning it more strongly. And I'm wondering if you are at all concerned now that you're at the apex of both of these issues, whether one is fighting the other. I mean, if you increase law enforcement scrutiny of school behavior under the rubric of bullying, are you concerned that it then sends more kids into the system and triggers more disciplinary responses, which then people will consider discriminatory?
Discipline and ensuring that students feel safe doesn't necessarily mean that students have to be kicked out of school. We have seen alternate disciplinary strategies that help to ensure students are reprimanded for bad behavior, also work to fix the culture of school so that all students feel safe and that kind of bullying and harassment isn't tolerated. But it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. In order to make all students feel safe, you don't in turn have to kick out most students, certainly not students of a certain race or sex.
What is the Department of Education doing to support this kind of nuanced approach that you would say would be the ideal from what I'm hearing you say?
We have for the last couple of years been working to support educators in the field with ensuring dollars can be used to support better school environment and alternative to disciplinary action strategies by ensuring that where appropriate, enforce the civil rights laws vigorously to ensure that these practices are implemented with fundamental fairness. We release these data in the spirit of transparency almost simultaneously to when we received it.
Just in the couple of minutes that we have left, I want to move a little bit away from discipline and talk about teachers and resources. The report finds that teachers in schools with a lot of minority students are getting paid less than their colleagues in mainly white schools, even in the same district. Why might that be?
How much teachers get paid is a function usually of a lockstep single salary schedule. Things like how many years of experience they have, how many credentials they have, how many master's degrees or higher education degrees they have. So that's one of the causes of these disparities. That, though, is linked to patterns where we see almost everywhere across the country that schools that serve mostly African American and Latino students employ most most of the teachers that are newest to the profession. Those teachers, their salaries are a lot less than experienced teachers that are clustered in schools serving mostly affluent and white students.
So is it that the more experienced teachers get, the more likely they are to move to majority white districts? Or is it that the teachers in majority white districts tend to stay there long enough to aggregate more salary, whereas there's more turnover in the minority heavy districts?
Both. There's more turnover in the minority heavy districts, in part because the teachers leave.
Mm-mm. Okay. And finally, Hispanic and African American majority schools are also offering fewer high level courses like calculus and physics than white majority schools. And again, what do we know about why this happens? And do you see a remedy?
That is a hugely important concern, especially as we work to achieve the president's goal that by 2020 we will lead the world once again in the percentage of college graduates. If students are not ready for college by the time they graduate high school, they will be ill-prepared to succeed in the demands of post-secondary work, whether they're in an apprenticeship program or a 2 or 4 year college. It is also hard to know why that is, but for sure we know that schools serving mostly African American and Latino students now, for the first time ever, we know that they are far less likely to have those higher rigor courses. Some say it's because we don't have the resources to have the labs and the supports and the interventions in those schools. Some say, unfortunately, it's because kids can't do it. But we know that that myth has been debunked, because when we provide students with those rigorous courses and the supports they and their teachers need to succeed, they will soar.
Ruslan Ali is the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Education. She was kind enough to join us here in our studios here in Washington, D.C. Assistant Secretary Ali, thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
In this country, many American kids are preparing for standardized tests. They're among the rites of spring, and they cause a lot of stress. One Indiana school tries to manage that stress by obsessing over the test a little less. Rather than teaching every single thing on the test, they just teach how to take one. Here's Kyle Stokes of NPR member station WFIU.
Quick, name the literary genres you learned about in school.
You learn how to write poetry. You learn how to read nonfiction. You learn how to read historical fiction.
Heather Barron-Cadill is the curriculum coach at the Project School. It's a small K-9 charter school in Bloomington, Indiana, that prides itself on doing things differently, and test prep is no exception.
We see testing as a genre.
That's right. The Project School teaches standardized testing as a literary genre, right alongside the memoir and the short story. So how do teachers get from T.S. Eliot to testing? It's like learning to understand a poem by breaking it down to its rhythm and meter. Barron-Cadill says teachers present test-taking tips in much the same way. Get stuck on a question, come back to it later. Got to tackle a dense essay, take a critical look at the prompt first.
We want them to know what kinds of questions come up, but yet we're not going to sit there and spend the year learning how to take a test like some places do.
Teachers spend a 2-week unit on test preparation, and after that, it's back to regularly scheduled programming, allowing teachers more freedom in the classroom. Some parents aren't so keen on downplaying attention to statewide exams, but the school's condensed approach to test prep is part of what led Gina Carney to enroll her son at the Project School.
We weren't drawn to the Project School because they have this specific way of teaching about standardized testing. I would say that it would be the opposite of that, is that they don't have a really stressed out attitude about standardized testing. They're not focused on it.
So if testing is a genre and the wrong answers are A, C, and D, the Project School hopes their quirky approach can help students answer the age-old question, to be or not to be. For NPR News, I'm Kyle Stokes.
And if anybody should ask you during a test, you can tell them that that story was from State Impact, a project from NPR and its member stations examining how state policy affects American lives.
Getting pulled by the ear for misbehaving in class or lying across a teacher's legs for a spanking may seem like a relic of the past, but 19 states still allow public schools to paddle students who behave badly. According to the Center for Effective Discipline, most incidents take place in rural parts of the mountain and southern states, where such punishment is something of a tradition. Well, now in Florida, a mother plans to sue a school district because her 5-year-old son was paddled without her permission. WLRN Miami Herald reporter Sarah Gonzalez went to small-town Florida to find out why schools want the right to spank students.
There are some parts of Florida where getting spanked at school on your butt with a wooden or fiberglass board isn't a big deal.
You put your hands on the desk and look forward.
You just get hit 2 or 3 times and then it's over with.
I've been getting them since about first grade, just regular.
That's Cole Long, Claire Ginn, and Lucas Mixon, middle and high school students in North Florida, where almost every county has laws on the books allowing the paddling of students. Public schools are the only public institution where hitting is allowed, not in prisons, hospitals, mental institutions, or the military. The most recent data shows about 3,600 students were spanked in Florida in 2010. Efforts to ban school corporal punishment statewide failed this year. And that's just fine for parents like Bud Glover of Bonifay, Florida.
I got my butt beat. I know what's right and wrong, and my children are going to know what's right and wrong.
Bonifay is a small town in the Florida Panhandle, 15 miles from the Alabama border, where tradition is valued. And Eddie Dixon, principal at Holmes County High School, is a traditionalist when it comes to spanking misbehaving students.
Well, it's just, that kind of thing. And that doesn't really hurt, it's just the sound.
It's a wooden board, and it sure looks like it hurts. Picture a really short rowboat paddle, a rectangle with a handle about 16 inches long, 5 inches wide, and 1/2 inch thick. Students at the high school get paddled about twice a week for doing things like,
oh, doing stupid stuff, throwing papers, throwing pencils, a couple times for cussing, and then back talking. I used to be a really wild child.
That's Cole Long, a senior at Holmes County High. He says the spankings teach students discipline and respect. But every once in a while, a parent from one of these small towns will say, that's my job, like Tanika Jones of Levy County. Last year, the principal at Joyce Bullock Elementary sent home a waiver asking parents for permission to paddle students. Jones didn't sign it, but her son, Jirye Bostic, was paddled on his second week of preschool anyway. Jirye says the principal spanked him twice for slapping another boy on the school bus.
He said, take my jacket off. Then when I take my jacket off, then spank me with my booty. Then it was hard, then I cried. Then I said sorry. Then we went on the bus. Then I cried all the way home. It was really hard.
The paddling left welts on Jirye's bottom, and his mom was outraged.
If I would have hit my son how she hit him, I would have been in jail. I would have been on the news. I would have been messed up trying to get my children back how she hit my son. She whipped him up, and to me, that's child abuse.
Jirye's mom is in the process of suing the Levy County School District for paddling her son without her permission. But state law does not require schools to get parental consent. The school's principal and the school district would not comment because they're in pre-litigation. But the principal has said that permission slips are only a courtesy. Many studies on school corporal punishment show paddling does not deter kids from misbehaving. Students who are paddled once are often re-paddled. But supporters argue that paddling punishes students and keeps them in school, because the alternative for students with bad behavior would be suspension. Willie Williams agrees. He's principal at Madison County Central Elementary and Middle School. The only problem is he can't bring himself to administer the punishment. And when others do it?
I have to walk out. I'm a softy really at heart. I actually have to walk out because I just...
As principal, Williams could ban the practice.
If I believed in that, but I am a part of the community.
And he says this community supports school corporal punishment. And in rural Florida, that's not likely to change anytime soon. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Gonzalez in Miami.
That story is part of the State Impact Project. State Impact is a collaboration between NPR and member stations examining the effect of state policy on people's lives.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.